Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Steffi Woolhandler, a Physicians for a National Health Program, who assesses the health care reform bill signed into law by President Obama, which she says further entrenches the private for-profit health insurance industry. Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, who takes a closer look at the recent friction between the U.S. and Israel over Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's expansion of settler housing in East Jerusalem. And Dana Frank, professor of history at the University of California, who reports on the continuing repression and resistance in Honduras after a new government replaced the regime which overthrew the nation's president in June. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A new political party in Colombia, the Party of National Integration, or PIN, which has ties to right-wing paramilitary groups, won 8 seats in the mid-March congressional election. This gives the party considerable influence in the majority of conservative parties, loyal to President Álvaro Uribe, who is barred by law from seeking a third term as president. Among the PIN candidates elected to the Colombian Senate is Teresita Garcia, the sister of Alvaro Garcia, a former senator who was recently sentenced to 40 years in prison for helping plan a massacre. Leon Valencia of the New Rainbow, a policy group that has exposed links between paramilitaries and lawmakers, told the Washington Post, "The rapid rise of PIN as a legitimate political force is very grave and shows that the armed groups still have influence over the Congress." Since 2006, Colombian prosecutors have launched investigations against 80 members of Congress for working with paramilitary groups, who have killed thousands of civilians. Many of these indicted politicians have close ties with President Uribe. After a lobbying blitz by Japan, the United Nations-backed Convention on the International Trade in Endangered Species rejected a ban on the export of Atlantic bluefin tuna, served in fancy sushi restaurants. Monaco, with the active support of the United States, sought an outright ban on the export of the high-priced bluefin tuna. Environmental critics say the body that regulates fishing of bluefin tuna, the International Commission of the Conservation of Atlantic Tuna, lacks the political will to enforce tough catch limits. Population levels of the bluefin tuna have fallen by 80% since 1970. A single bluefin tuna can sell on the open market for as much as $120,000. Glenn Sant of Traffic, an international wildlife trade monitoring network, told the BBC that the broad rejection of the export ban on the bluefin tuna was a significant blow to marine conservation. This is the second time Japan has led the opposition to a ban on the export of bluefin tuna. A similar motion by Sweden in 1992 was soundly defeated. Dutch Prime Minister Jan-Peter Balkenende has denounced the comments of former NATO Supreme Commander General John Sheehan for linking gay Dutch soldiers to the massacre in Srebrenica in 1995, where Serb forces killed 8,000 Muslim men and boys. Sheehan, a retired US general, made his comment at a hearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee, which is reviewing the Pentagon's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy on banning gays from the military. Sheehan claimed the presence of gay Dutch soldiers who served as peacekeepers in Srebrenica led to poor morale and being overrun by Serb forces. Dutch Prime Minister Balkenende called General Sheehan's comments outrageous, wrong and beneath contempt. The United Nations War Crimes Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague classified the Srebrenica massacre of Muslims as genocide and the worst atrocity in Europe since the end of World War II. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Prue Cullen.
The House of Representatives passed the Senate version of the health care reform bill on March 21st, capping more than a year of bitter and polarizing debate. The law President Barack Obama signed 2 days later further entrenches the private for-profit health insurance industry after universal health care activists lost the battle for single-payer insurance and the less ambitious public option. A bill proposing improvements to the new law has passed the House and will soon be considered by the Senate. Physicians for a National Health Program, or PNHP, has 17,000 members who have been fighting for decades to establish a single-payer system, sometimes referred to by supporters as Medicare for All. The group says that President Obama's bill fails to provide insurance coverage to about 23 million people, which will result in an estimated 23,000 unnecessary deaths annually. PNHP also criticizes the legislation for pressuring millions of middle-income people to buy commercial health insurance policies that will only cover an average 70% of their medical expenses, making them vulnerable to financial hardship and/or bankruptcy. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Physicians for a National Health Program co-founder Steffi Woolhandler, who is a practicing physician in the Boston area and on the faculty of the Harvard Medical School. She says most members of her organization, while acknowledging some positive aspects of the bill, such as preventing insurance companies from dropping people with pre-existing conditions, thinks those benefits are outweighed by the negatives.
We feel that this is a debate about Tylenol versus aspirin for breast cancer. The patient needs surgery, and nothing in this bill solves the problems in health care. It's still dominated by the insurance industry, and the insurance industry dominance is why we have uninsured people in the first place, is why we have costs that are twice as high as other developed nations where they use nonprofit national health insurance. So to continue down this same path with the private health insurance industry in charge is simply not a solution. We are not going to get to universal health care that's affordable for the American people.
You know, analysts are comparing this to the Clinton plan 15 years ago, which was fought tooth and nail by the insurance industry and went down in flames. This one succeeded with support from the very interests that you think are the problem. But given the united front from the Republicans, do you think it could have had a different outcome, honestly?
Definitely there was buy-in to the bill by the insurance industry and by the pharmaceutical industry. But to get that buy-in, the Obama administration had to make huge compromises, and once they made the compromise with the private insurance industry, they were left with a series of unpalatable choices, limiting the coverage, leaving 23 million people uninsured at the end of the next decade. The choice, they had to cut Medicare, particularly Medicare funds for safety net hospitals and clinics. They had to force middle-income people to pay thousands of dollars for coverage so skimpy, so full of gaps like copayments and deductibles, that you can have the insurance and still not be able to afford care. And then they had to put a tax on the benefits of workers in order to pay for it. So by putting the private health insurance industry with their extremely high overhead, the wasteful paperwork that they impose on the healthcare system, Obama had to do a lot of things that were rightfully unpopular with the electorate and are very negative aspects of the bill.
Steffi Woolhandler, there's evidence that when previous major social programs were passed, they were not so comprehensive either due to political compromise, but eventually became more universal. Do you think that's likely to happen here?
These major social programs that start small and grew, such as the Medicare program, such as Social Security, none of them started by giving $447 billion to private industry. And that's what this bill does, is $447 billion in taxpayer money that's being handed over to private health insurance as subsidies for the purchase of private policies. So that money has the effect of strengthening the private insurance industry financially and politically, and giving them increased strength to try to block reform in the future. So, I'm wishing I would be very happy to hear that this was the beginning of something that was going to improve. I'm frankly not particularly optimistic. I think we do need to continue to push for Medicare for All, single-payer national health insurance.
So do you think this bill is worse than if nothing had been done to address the problem?
Well, all of the same problems will continue to exist: the high cost of health care, the inability of families to get access to care, the problem of medical bankruptcy. So all of the problems that pushed us to health reform in the first place are still going to be there, and that's the reason why there will be a movement for real reform. I think there's a lot of confusion engendered by the bill, and that for the next couple of years we'll probably hear somewhat less about health care reform. And I don't anticipate the kind of debate we've had in the last year, the kind of active debate to be seen over the next 2 or 3 years. But very soon it will become obvious that none of the problems in the healthcare system have been solved, and the debate for reform will rise up again.
What does Physicians for a National Health Program plan to do now to move forward?
We plan to continue to advocate for nonprofit national health insurance, also known as Medicare for All, also known as single payer. That's the technique that most other developed nations have used to achieve universal coverage. People in Canada, for instance, where they have Medicare for All, have free access to any doctor and hospital. There's no co-payments, no deductibles for covered services. And Canadians live 2 years longer than Americans. They have lower infant mortality. They have lower death rates from heart disease and treatable cancers. So we know from international experience that a Medicare for All approach will allow you to cover everyone affordably. And what's gone on in Washington will simply not get the job done.
That was Dr. Steffi Wollhandler, co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. Contact the group's Chicago office at area code 312-782-6007 or visit their website at pnhp.org. Rare friction between the U.S. and Israel became public during a visit to Israel by Vice President Joe Biden on March 9th, after the government of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced the approval of 1,600 new settler homes to be built in an ultra-Orthodox East Jerusalem neighborhood. Reacting to the incident, Mr. Biden condemned the announced housing expansion, stating that it undermined the planned launch of proximity talks between Israeli and Palestinian officials. Although Israel considers East Jerusalem annexed in 1967 as part of its territory, building on occupied land is illegal under international law. Almost 500,000 Jewish settlers now live in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. Before coming to Washington for talks with President Obama, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and to address the influential American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, Prime Minister Netanyahu refused to reverse his government's authorization for building new housing in East Jerusalem. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, who examines the recent friction between the U.S. and Israel over settler housing expansion and the prospects for restarting Israeli-Palestinian peace talks.
Settlement expansion has been the constant since the war in 1967. The first settlement was built in 1968, and settlements throughout the West Bank, through Gaza until 2005, and throughout occupied Arab East Jerusalem has been a consistent feature. What was a little different over the last year was that we heard from the Obama administration something that was quite rare, not unheard of entirely, but quite rare for U.S. presidents, and that was a fairly straightforward series of requests for Israel to freeze settlements. There was no request that it dismantle existing settlements, which of course are a violation of international law, but a request to freeze settlement construction, which ironically enough Israel had actually agreed to do when they signed the so-called roadmap back in 2004. But put aside what Israel had agreed to do, because we know that's never an indication of what they will do, this was a little different for the Obama administration to say, we want you to freeze settlements very directly. The problem was Israel came back and said, no. So the U.S. said, please freeze settlements. No. Please freeze a few settlements. No. Please freeze just a few settlements, just for a little while, and you can exclude Jerusalem. Maybe. No. And then the U.S. basically stopped asking. So what they never did do, what the Obama administration never did do, was engage in serious pressure. There was a lot of talk about how the Obama administration is pressuring Israel. Oh, my God, what does that mean? Well, I don't know exactly what it would have meant because it didn't happen. What pressure would have meant would have been to say to the Israelis, all your settlements are illegal. The first step towards dealing with that illegality is to freeze all settlement construction, period, full stop, now. And when Israel came back and said no, the answer then is, okay, if you choose not to, you know that $30 billion that President George Bush agreed to give you in military aid, only military aid, over the next 10 years? $30 billion in military aid. You can kiss that goodbye. That's what pressure looks like. Or it says, you know how we've protected Israel at the United Nations? We've prevented discussion of the Goldstone Report. We've prevented Israel from being held accountable for its violations of international law, for its violations of UN Security Council resolutions, etc. You know how we've done that all those years? We're not doing that anymore. That's what pressure looks like. We didn't have any pressure. All we had were requests that were then abandoned when the country being requested said no.
Phyllis, we have President Obama's Middle East envoy, George Mitchell, who, as you mentioned, is going to begin these proximity talks, these indirect talks between Palestinians and Israelis. What is the perspective on the potential success of these talks in the Arab world and in the European capitals?
I don't think that anybody believes that these talks are going to go anywhere. There's no indication from the Israelis that they have, in fact, there's quite the contrary view from the Israeli side. They have agreed to nothing other than to participate in the talks. They have made clear that they are not changing their position. Their refusal to even negotiate with Hamas, their refusal to negotiate over Jerusalem, these remain their continuing positions. They're willing to go through the charade because the U.S. has asked them to, and they can do that without any real cost, in the same way that they have gone through whatever it is now, 18, 19 years of the, quote, peace process, which is all about process. It's all about Israeli diplomats and Israeli experts of various sorts flying off to various capitals to meet with their counterparts in the Palestinian Authority. And everybody gets to know each other, and there's proximity talks and direct talks and head-to-head talks, and there's the roadmap and the quartet and all of these diplomatic fictions to mask the fact that on the ground, the only change is the consolidation of Israeli settlement processes, the expansion of existing settlements, the building of new settlements, and the stealing of more Palestinian land and water. So that's, I think, understood widely in the Arab world, partially in Europe. In Europe, we see in civil society a much clearer understanding of the potential failures of the U.S.-led process. What we do see among European governments is an eagerness to maintain the fiction that they are somehow playing a role through their involvement in the so-called quartet. I think that in the Arab world, there is enormous anger at the level of civil society, at the level of the so-called Arab street. Governments are becoming unnerved enough so that the traditional willingness of Arab regimes dependent on the United States to go through the motions of various cosmetic normalization with Israel are becoming less willing to do that because they get nothing back, and their own populations are rising in rebellion against that. So the U.S. is becoming more and more isolated.
Phyllis, there's a lot of pressure on Barack Obama not to put pressure on the government of Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel. By the same token, Netanyahu's right-wing allies in his Israeli government are certainly going to pressure him not to make any concessions. Is there any clear path out of this, or is this continuing, ongoing, many decade-long crisis in the Middle East, unsolvable here? I mean, is there any hope?
I don't think it's unsolvable at all, Scott. I think you're right in your assessment of the Netanyahu government. I mean, this is a government that has a range from the right to the extreme right to the fascist right, and I use that term quite advisedly. And the pressure on Netanyahu from his right is extraordinary, as you say. On the other hand, here in Washington, I think the situation is very different. I think that the Obama administration and many in Congress are simply not aware or are not willing to acknowledge what they do know about how the discourse has changed in this country. It is no longer political suicide to talk about holding Israel accountable, ending the $30 billion subsidy to the Israeli Defense Forces that we are providing out of tax money. I think that it simply is no longer political suicide.
That was Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Visit the group's website at ips-dc.org. Phyllis Bennis is the author of Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, A Primer. Most governments around the world rejected the legitimacy of the November 29th presidential election in Honduras, which took place under the authority of the regime that overthrew the nation's democratically elected President Manuel Zelaya on June 28th last year. But the Obama administration is now urging nations across Latin America to recognize the new Honduran president, Porfirio Lobo, a conservative businessman with links to those who organized the coup. Groups resisting the coup d'etat urge a boycott of the November 29th election that resulted in only a 35% to 40% voter turnout. While in Guatemala in early March, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced Washington will restore more than $30 million in aid to Honduras that was suspended after the coup. But while the Obama administration is attempting to sweep the Honduran coup under the rug, repression of opposition groups continues. Three journalists have recently been assassinated by unknown assailants, in addition to a series of deadly attacks targeting activists and media outlets associated with groups that resisted the coup. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dana Frank, professor of history at University of California, Santa Cruz. Frank, who recently returned from a fact-finding trip to Honduras, describes a broad coalition of progressive organizations mobilized and motivated in the face of growing repression.
I have to say I was incredibly excited about the way the resistance movement is uniting all the social movements in the country for the first time. And it was really amazing, especially the young people were just really different. They had this excited energy. People were falling all over themselves to tell me their stories of the demonstrations they've been to and singing songs and chants. And this is really new in Honduras. Honduras was sort of known as the political black hole of Central America. And for a long time, people have been worrying. You know, progressives have been worried about young people not being very politicized. And you know, I really saw all kinds of young people, in fact, outflanking their parents politically. You know, on the other hand, the people in their 50s, 60s and older, you know, you could also see that these people understand how terrifyingly dangerous the situation is because, and they have a very sober feel. You can know being with people that you know could be killed at any moment. And their children could be killed at any moment. When I was there, I was on the radio with a man named Pedro Brizuela, who's been a lifelong leftist who works with the Garifuna people on the North Coast, has a radio show on an alternative opposition radio station. And I was on the radio with him on a Wednesday, came home on Sunday, and on the following Wednesday, his 36-year-old daughter was assassinated in her front door, right in front of her young children. And it was clearly a message to Pedro that if you don't stop, we're going to kill your children. And, of course, every activist in the country knows how terrifying that is. In the last 3 weeks, three journalists have been killed, one the news director of a television station. And it's a very scary kind of state terror where ordinary people are being killed seemingly randomly by paramilitaries, and no one knows who's next, and that's part of what's so terrifying. They're not knocking off the top leaders because they know that that would cause immediate outrage internationally. Instead, it's this low-level, really terrifying kind of assassinations of regular people in the resistance.
Dana, tell us about this group that emerged to confront the coup government, the Frente Nacional de Resistencia Popular.
Well, it's much more than a group. It's a really huge, broad national coalition. It's not run by a particular political party. It's not whether leftist or the center-left electoral party. It's really a broad coalition of all the social movements in the country. So the labor movement, the women's movement, the human rights groups, environmental campesino groups, the campesino movement, also, most amazingly, the gay and lesbian movement is very much front and center in this movement, which is really an astonishing thing. So to see all these people working together, it's a coalition with delegates from all those groups, official delegates as well as regional delegates. And it's really amazing to see all these people working together. And it's not the other group that's in there is also the people who were from the Zelaya wing of the Liberal Party, and the Liberal Party has really fallen apart. One half was with Zelaya, and the other part was, well, perhaps more than half, the other part was supporting Micheletti and the coup. So this is not a political party, although the Frente Nacional de Resistencia Popular, the Frente, has said that with eventually they are going to become a political party, but they really are consolidating themselves at grassroots. And what started as opposition to a military coup and the seizure of a constitutional order and a desire to restore constitutional order through Zelaya was always much more than just supporting Zelaya. Lots of people are critical of Zelaya, but understood that he represented the rule of law. And now it's sort of all bets are off. Everybody's saying, well, wait a minute, why are we putting up with these oligarchs in the first place? It's sort of exposed the way the oligarchs control the great majority of the media, and the media just lied so outright during the coup that that discredited most of them, all of the mainstream media. And people are really saying, okay, let's go for broke here. They're talking about land rights. They're talking about labor rights. They're talking about GLBT rights. They're talking about a country really run by the vast majority of the population, because listeners should know that, you know, the whole middle class of Honduras isn't more than 4% of the whole country, and these 13 very, very elite families are way above the middle class, and they've been running this country for decades and decades with the U.S. at their military back, and the Honduran people are really now all together saying enough, and it's a very exciting moment and obviously very dangerous.
You believe that this is a critical moment in time for the Honduran resistance movement, the progressive forces there, for U.S. solidarity to be evidenced so that the Obama administration and the oligarchs there in that country can't step up the repression.
Yeah, I think what happens in the next few months is going to be really critical, and everybody knows that. I mean, of course, it's been critical for 9 months, but we can't let this get normalized. And people need to be talking to their Congress people immediately. We need to be cutting off U.S. aid. The U.S. Hillary Clinton has already announced they're restoring aid. We need to stop that. We need to get these Honduran generals out of the School of Americas. We need to close the Palmarola Air Force Base. We need to be contacting the White House, the State Department, and whoever your Congress person is. I mean, they have this beautiful movement from below of all these social movements, and we need to have our own beautiful movement from below supporting the Honduran people. And women's groups, environmental groups, unions, GLBT groups, faith-based communities need to really be talking back about this and not let Obama and Clinton get away with this. It's very scary.
That was Dana Frank, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Read her recent Nation magazine article, Honduran's Great Awakening, online at thenation.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced in association with WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Prue Cullen, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.